Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We've got an interesting show planned today. Later on this hour, we're going to be talking about colorism. This is the idea, a prejudice, often within racial or ethnic groups, that favors lighter skin tones. We're also going to be taking a dive into the state's new metrics, regions, and mitigation measures intended to deal with the pandemic. And we're hoping to bring you a conversation with Illinois Department of Public Health Director Ngazi Ezike. As yesterday, the Illinois Department of Public Health reported that there were 156,693 confirmed cases of COVID-19, including 7,226 deaths. The state, as I said, just also announced new metrics, regions, and mitigation measures to deal with the pandemic, and we're going to dig into that a little later in the show. But first, we are now joined by the state's top health official dealing with the pandemic. Dr. Ngazi Ezike is the director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. She's also a pediatrician by training. Dr. Ezike, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
So for those of us armchair epidemiologists who obsessively track the numbers every day, yesterday, Wednesday, there were 1,187 newly confirmed cases reported by the Department of Public Health. That's not all that much higher than the 7-day average for new cases, so it's not an outlier. But it is up 34% over a week earlier and 50% over late June when Illinois entered phase four of easing restrictions and allowing businesses to reopen. I wonder, to what do you attribute that increase? Is this more testing? Are we finding cases that were probably out there already? Or are we actually seeing more infections happening?
Yeah. No, I'm so glad that everyone is joining the ranks of public health and epidemiologists. We are happy to have more people doing this work. I think it's really important that we do remember when we talk about the new cases each day, that would be the numerator if we talk about the fraction, and the denominator is how many tests were actually done. And so for sure, we have to think about how tests that we were completing used to be 10,000, 15,000, then they creeped up to 20,000. For the last 24 hours, we had our biggest day, and we had over 40,000 tests that were resulted. So we absolutely know that part of the increase in the number of cases is related to testing. But we also know that, yeah, there are some spots around the state that are having more positive cases, even when you take out the increased testing. So in some places, it's strictly more testing identifies more cases. There are some parts of the state that you can say they are maybe having some increased rates, increased transmission, and that's some of the reason for the increased rate. So it's definitely a mixed bag.
And what do we know about who is getting sick now? I understand there's a rise in cases among younger people, which is maybe something we weren't seeing as much in the earlier phases of this pandemic.
Absolutely. That's such an important point, and we really have to drive that home. I spend hours with the data team. They spend their whole day looking at this. And so when they break it down, I have seen that the highest, the group with the highest positivity rate are actually the 20 to 29-year-olds. They were never the highest group before. It used to be our more elderly population. A lot of the cases were driven previously by individuals in the long-term care facilities, the nursing homes, and the skilled nursing facilities. But right now, our highest positivity rates are in our 20 to 29-year-olds, and then that next highest group are our 10 to 19-year-olds. So 10 to 30-year-olds are having the highest rate of infection.
And so what can you say what some of the specific hotspots have been as a matter of category? I think you were the governor yesterday in your news conference mentioned a youth softball league. We've heard about bars that have been tied to outbreaks. Is there something that people are doing that is driving these increases?
You know, what's driving the increases is just the doing. And there's so much doing, right? So when we graduated to phase four on June 26th, we opened up quite a bit. You know, we had the indoor dining, we have indoor recreational, we have, you know, bars, we have gyms. So a lot opened. So just a lot more movement, a lot more opportunities for gathering. And we're just seeing that, of course, there's no way that that, you know, that amount of gathering and congregating will not result in more opportunities for people to get infected. And so we have to combine the gathering and the movement with the mitigation strategies such as masking and distancing to really counter and make sure that we don't lose the wonderful gains that we made. Illinois is one of the few states that's on everybody's list of people who have low positivity rates, that we've brought down infection, but that is, it's very tenuous because as people are trying to get back to work and get back to their lives and get back to some of the social activities, there's a high risk of reversing the gains if we don't do something to counter the gathering. And that something would be masking and distancing and, of course, washing our hands.
And I just want to remind our listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Dr. Ngozi Ezike. She is the director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. You can always join our conversations at 800-222-9455. The number again is 800-222-9455. Well, Dr. Ezike, we're talking about gatherings, and one place that I think a lot of parents in Illinois are both eager and concerned about gatherings are schools this fall. I wonder, what is your best estimate right now as we sit in mid-July of the idea that students will be returning to school in person? We've seen other places in the country say they're already going virtual for the fall semester. In Illinois, do you think students will be back in the classroom this fall?
You know, we have been working, IDPH, the governor's team, the State Board of Education, we have been meeting for hours and hours on end for so long. Of course, everyone would like to be able to see our students in school, to have in-person learning. I think we're preparing for all possibilities. It's really hard to predict what will be happening when school starts, you know, a few weeks away for some. We might have a month. I think some places start after Labor Day. So much can happen, and a lot of what determines what happens when school starts is based on what happens now. So if we don't get a hold on some of the mild increases that are occurring now, if we don't do the masking and distancing and washing our hands to keep the rates down now, these rates could get so high where it wouldn't be safe for school. And so everyone's actions are really interconnected to what the community can take. And I can't ever get, I don't have the magic wand to look ahead and see exactly what it's going to look like on the first day of school. But I know we're working hard to make sure that we can create the safest environment in school. And so if it's 100% in person, or if it's partial, or if it's a combination, we just have to see, but we know that we are going to prioritize the safety of the students and the teachers and the aides and all the administrators associated with the schools as we make these decisions, getting closer and closer to D-Day, if you will.
Yeah. You know, and I wonder, as the director of public health, obviously there are public health costs to having kids out of school, right? Hunger is said to increase because so many students are dependent on getting meals at school. We've seen reports that child abuse hotline calls are down, which is taken to mean as a bad thing because teachers are not seeing potentially abused students. How do you weigh those harms against, you know, in fighting this disease versus the, you know, the serious costs, not just to learning and socialization, but also the health costs to students for not being in school?
Absolutely. I thank you for bringing that up. All of those are major considerations, and which is why we want in-person school. We also have health services that are delivered through school that maybe people wouldn't get, the dental services that are provided in many schools, the actual hearing and screening, hearing and vision screening that occur. All of these things are things that could be lost if people are not in school, as well as the meals that you mentioned. And I will say that most districts did find a way to continue to give kids these meals. There were pickup spots where families could go and pick up the meals that would have been given during the school day. But those are all important considerations that people have to take into account and realize that school provides, like you said, so much more than just, you know, the three R's and socialization. So we're thinking about all of that and working so hard to make school happen. But I need everyone's help because we can't have widespread transmission throughout the community and then think we can safely do school. So we're working so hard now to keep the numbers low, to keep transmission under control. We need everyone to help us with the masking so that we can get there, and then we can all try to get our kids into school in the fall.
You know, speaking of what we can do now, I would gather that as public health director, a large part of your job is persuasion, right? And I've seen a report that if everybody wore masks, the virus could be pretty well controlled in a matter of weeks. And I wonder, how do you reach people for whom not wearing a mask has become part of their identity? Maybe they view it as a statement of their values of individual liberty and freedom. How do you, what is being done to reach those citizens of Illinois?
Yeah, so as we're seeing that younger people are having the higher positivity rates now, we had already developed a youth forum because we really want to be able to speak to the people that we need to speak to. And we're going to be talking, having ongoing conversations with young people. Let's figure out the messaging and some of the preliminary talks. We've heard that some people think, well, we heard that we don't get sick, so why do we have to care so much? And so we have to identify the education that's needed and the right way to deliver that education, the right platform on which to put that education so that people can really hear the right message and hear accurate information. We did spend so much time talking about, you know, comorbidities and elderly people that maybe people have not picked up on the fact that this virus has unfortunately sickened and killed people of every single age group, from infants on to 100-plus-year-old individuals. And there have been people without comorbidities, without pre-existing medical conditions, as well as people with medical conditions. And so there's no one that's immune. We have to make sure young people understand that. And we also have to make sure that they understand that even if you didn't get severely ill, it doesn't stop you from transmitting it to someone who could get severely ill. And that could be one of your other young friends who maybe had, you know, Hodgkin's, you know, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma as a child or childhood leukemia, and perhaps is immunocompromised in such a way that getting this virus could portend a very bad outcome. You could be unwittingly infecting your parents or your grandparents or employers or any other number of people. And so just being able to show them the whole picture, hopefully that will be enough to impress upon them their direct role in keeping our whole state safe and being able to try to change behaviors that will be very critical to keeping the whole state in the best position possible.
Sure.
And I want to fiercely protect the gains that we have made.
And the last question I want to ask you, I know your time is very limited today, but I just want to step back in time to early March. I was in the room when you testified before a Senate Public Health Committee hearing. At the time, Illinois had just 4 confirmed cases of COVID-19, but we've later seen a study from Northeastern that projected there could have been as many as 3,300 infections in Chicago. And I wonder both what prevented us from grasping the full extent of the disease at that time, and do you stay up at night wondering if there's something we're missing now?
There's always something that we don't know. I think we called it the novel coronavirus because it's just that. It's a virus we've never seen before. You know, we think it originated in just December of 2019. We think we know when it started hitting hitting our shores, but there's so much that we don't know. We're learning every day. I have colleagues and classmates that I converse with who are in Korea, where I'm trying to get some information from them on strategies that have been helpful. You know, they had school since March and then closed it and opened again. So I'm trying to glean as much as possible. But again, we don't have textbooks of previous run-ins with this virus to be able to give us like a blueprint. We literally are, you know, crafting the plane as we're trying to fly it. So yes, there are things that we think we know that maybe with additional research and with additional data, we'll learn more, or it'll become more nuanced, or it might be adjusted. And we have to be able to be nimble enough to be responsive to data and make changes as we go along. So we don't know everything, but we're trying to use everything that we do know to keep people as safe as possible. And I'm hoping that the public understands that we are diligently working to learn all that we can.
And I'm afraid we have to leave it there. Dr. Ngozi Ezike, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.